It's kind of faded recently, this last generation at least. There used to be a big emphasis on etiquette. There were columns in the paper where you could write your questions about proper etiquette and have somebody answer them. It was concern about etiquette. Etiquette was the way in which you act. And by following certain rules, you show that you fit in with a certain class of people. And those who were in that class, or those who aspired to that class, wanted to fit in. Rules of etiquette are sort of like rules of grammar. If people use the rules of grammar properly, then they sound more educated. And if they don't, then they sound less educated. So people were concerned about following the right rules. And the clearest example I can think of how those rules set people apart was, say you go out to a fancy restaurant and there's all these knives and forks in front of you, and you have to figure out which utensil to use at which time for what food. And if you don't know that, then it can be embarrassing. And there's this subtle pressure to say that you don't belong in a restaurant for fancy food. It seems like Jesus is focusing on etiquette here, which is kind of confusing because Jesus has so little time in his ministry. But that's what we have today, in a sense, is Jesus talking about proper behavior. He starts off talking about a banquet. We don't have that many banquets anymore, and not the kind that would have been a common occurrence in Jesus' day. So probably for us, the closest we could come to would be like a wedding reception. So taking Jesus' metaphor and moving it up to today, imagine a wedding reception, and often when you go into the room where the reception is happening, there's a table at the front of the room where the bride and the groom sit, and those closest to the bride and groom. And then there are other tables close to that table where close family members sit, and then the further you get away, the less close you are to the family, or to the bride and groom. So imagine, imagine a wedding in which the bride invites her cousin. Now, she's not particularly close to her cousin. She hasn't spent any time with her cousin, but her cousin is the only child of her aunt, and so she feels obligated to invite him to the wedding and the reception. The cousin believes that he's invited not just because he's a cousin, but because he's a celebrity. He is, after all, the mayor of Black Diamond, Washington. And so when he comes into the reception and sees there at the head table an open spot, he just assumes that that spot's for him because he is a person of importance. And so he goes up and sits there. And everybody at the wedding party looks at him like, "Who are you?" And he explains that he's a cousin to the bride and that he is the mayor of Black Diamond. Then there's a awkward silence, and then the bride gets up and quietly tells the cousin that that spot isn't for him, that his spot is actually back in the back of the room. And while she's pointing out the place in the back of the room, she looks back there and she sees a member of the wedding party, her good friend, sitting way back there. And so she calls her friend up forward to sit at the place that was supposed to be her place that the cousin was sitting in. So Jesus is pointing out in this situation that for the cousin who has to leave and go all the way to the back, it's kind of a humiliating situation. For the friend of the bride who comes from the back all the way forward, it's kind of an honor. It's in no way humiliating. And so Jesus says, if you want to be safe, if you want to do the right thing, always sit in the back. Then if you're supposed to be there, no problem. And if you're not supposed to be there and you're supposed to be closer to the front, Well, I'll call you up front, and everybody will say, hey, this person's more important, and it's getting called up to the front. So then Jesus takes this kind of mundane example and says, all those who seek to extend themselves, let me get the quote exactly here. All those who seek to exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Which seems a much bigger ending to this very simple example. Well, then Jesus gives a second example and says, and those of you who are going to have these meals and invite people over, don't invite your friends and your family, your neighbors, because then they're just going to invite you to one of their dinner parties, and you will just exchange one dinner for another. And there's nothing wrong with that, but there's nothing particularly good about that either. Jesus says, if you want to do something good, invite people who will never be able to invite you to a dinner because they will never be able to afford it. Invite people to the dinner who are in need of a meal. Do that, and there will be a blessing. And a blessing is much better than just a meal. It's kind of hard to figure out exactly what Jesus is about on the reading like this. It seems very mundane. Who you should throw your parties for and where you should sit. We have to ask ourselves, why would Jesus use this important time, very limited time in his life, to focus on such little things? And I think what he's doing here is setting an example for his followers and for us that little things are also important. He's building up the soil of social transformation. I think of that because I'm not exactly the best gardener in the world. And I have this thing where I never comprehended lawn. When I was a kid, I always had to mow the lawn and pull weeds out of the lawn, and it just seemed insane to pull one form of grass out of another form of grass so that it would have some sort of uniform look. And why was that important in the cosmic existence that we are moving through? I never understood lawn, and when I had my own lawn to keep track of, I begrudge it every time I have to take that old push mower out and try to mow it down. So whenever I have a chance, I dig it up and plant plants there that look good or taste good, and hopefully both. And then it makes sense. Those plants make sense to me. So I've done that a few places around my house, and one place right in front of the house, I dug up and got rid of all the weeds and all the plants and then that were there and loosened the soil and then went out and got some plants that I really liked, some really nice flowers and some vegetables, and I stuck them in the ground and nothing. I mean, the flowers came up and they were not very big and didn't look very good, and the vegetables, there was nothing produced that was edible. They just never made it. It wasn't because I got bad plants. I was really excited about the plants. It was because the soil wasn't good. I had done nothing with the soil except get rid of the old plants that were there. If you don't garden by building up the soil, then the plants you plant aren't going to do very well. And that's true with social change as well. We get excited about issues. We get excited about things that we see, great needs. We see somebody who's homeless and we want to figure out how to provide shelter for them. We see somebody who's hungry and we want to provide food for them. We see some injustice and we want to fix it by a particular piece of public policy. We see some clown doing the wrong job in their elected position, and we want to get somebody else in there. We get excited about those things, and we rush to create the program or advocate for the policy or get the right person elected. And we're often surprised to find that not as many people are as excited about this stuff as we are. And sometimes, even if you succeed and you get the right policy in place or the right person elected, they don't do what you'd hope they would do. A long time ago, people advocated that people who were disabled and unable to work needed to be supported, and so advocated for this program called SSI, Supplemental Security Income. And the idea of the program was great. You provide people who are disabled and unable to work with income and health care and give them a secure place in the world. It was a great idea, but there wasn't the ongoing support for the idea. And so the program now pays not nearly enough for someone to live in Seattle and have their own place. The only opportunity to have a decent housing in Seattle if you're on SSI is if you're lucky enough to get into subsidized housing. The program didn't follow through with its vision of giving people a secure place in the society. And the same could be said for welfare programs and food stamp programs, all of those programs which were created to meet a need, but then were allowed to wither. And often we're told, though, there just isn't the resources to pay for it. But it seems like whenever we need resources to build another aircraft carrier or give another tax break, that we can find it. It's not about the resources, it's about the will. And the will in a community is about the vision and the values of the people. And vision and values are built by little things. They're built by everyday conversations. They're built by everyday examples of compassion and empathy. They're built by works of art. They're built by people focusing on what's really important when they talk about the news. It's challenging people to seek an alternative worldview is the work of building the soil, so that if there is the expectation in the community that we all take care of each other, then programs that are built to care for one another will be created and they will be supported. And if we create a culture which says it's every person for themselves and that we're all self-made people pulling our own selves up by our bootstraps, and if you don't aren't making it, it's your own fault and too bad and we're not really going to care about you, then other outcomes will come. And there are people who are heavily invested in trying to press us towards a worldview which says it's every person for themselves. Because in those societies, they're succeeding. Walter Brueggemann, an Old Testament professor of mine, said when talking about that commandment in Micah that says, what does the Lord require? And one of them, those requirements, is to walk humbly with your God. Brueggemann says, to walk humbly with your God is to abandon all self-sufficiency, to acknowledge in daily attitude and act that life is indeed derived from the reality of God. Everything we are, everything around us, everything that's important, everything that's worthy, is derived from the reality of God, a God of love. Everything else is clutter and confusion. So whenever we live in that reality, whenever we reflect that reality in what we say and what we do, how we spend our time, how we spend our money, how we spend our enthusiasm, we're either reflecting that love or we're not. Or to use Jesus' term, we're either being a blessing or we're not. Jesus' work here isn't just the work of trying to transform who governs his nation. It is about building from the bottom up the expectations of the people about what a community does, what it values, how it lives out those values. This is our work. Not just getting involved in elections and protesting injustice and trying to advocate for proper public policy and supporting meal programs and housing programs. All of that is essential work and needs to be done. But on top of all of that is the work of transforming the culture. Our faith is not just about changing our lives, but about changing the world. And we can't do that unless we have a culture which acknowledges the value of each and every person in it. Working on the soil is our work. It's how we become good news.